At this time, it is my pleasure to introduce Ruben.
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Ruben. Most important thing I can share is I've been clean and sober since April the 2nd, 1985, so that I'm grateful. It's good to be here tonight, clean and sober, and I'd like to welcome all the newcomers. God answered my prayers tonight, and there's a lot of newcomers in here, and I can talk to you. And it's good. It's been a long time since I've seen this many newcomers in this meeting tonight, and I feel comfortable talking to the newcomers. And so it's good. Welcome to the newcomers. Those slipping and sliding in and out of their sobriety, I've been that too, and those having problems in their recovery. Because I've been all three of those, you know. And I want to get my thank yous out of the way. Thank those who are responsible for letting me be here tonight. The ladies from my home group, Godawana, out there. And the guys from my home group, Dog on the Roof, for being here and supporting me tonight. It's important. And it's good to be here. And Potter for a nice dinner over there at his house tonight. And hope I didn't forget anybody. Sometimes I'm kind of a serious person. I can get kind of introverted or real serious. And I was looking at this see-through podium, and I thought of a joke I'd heard somebody say one time. This guy walks into the psychiatrist's office, and he's completely naked, and he's wrapped in saran wrap. He said, "Doctor, what's wrong with me?" He says, "I'm not quite sure, but I can clearly see your nuts." And the best I can do. Sorry. Oh man, I loved listening to the people share in the meeting today. It was good. I've been to a lot of good meetings the last couple of days. I went to West Care last night, over to Detox and Sam House this morning, and hearing the newer people share. And I like that. You know, I like hearing raw alcoholism and people looking for recovery and for an answer, because I didn't come here this time looking for anything else but that, and I was looking for an answer to that. And when I heard the answer, I grabbed onto it, and it was refreshing to hear that, because I'd gone a lot of meetings when I was bouncing around in and out that you didn't hear the answer. All you heard about was the problem, and there wasn't any conviction, there wasn't any strength, there wasn't any peace or serenity from the people in the meeting. There wasn't definitely no old timers, and it was powerful to get around that when I happened to cross with that. Anyways, I've been taught to share what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today in a general way. And, you know, I was of love, growing up in a loving home, a home where they taught you morals and values. Would not make me an alcoholic, then I wouldn't be an alcoholic, because I don't have anybody to blame for my alcoholism. I grew up in a very loving home. There was structure, there was discipline, there was good values, and there was good morals. And I have a stepfather that raised me from when I was a little kid, and I was just shown all the right things to do. And but there was just a part of me that never wanted to do the right thing, and the grass is always greener. And I don't identify with people that think about that they were always inferior, and they were like aliens. They were dropped off from another planet looking for their home, and they were adopted. I always had this thing that I was just a little bit superior to everybody else, and I was waiting for people to recognize that. And I was a little frustrated because they weren't recognizing my abilities, and you know, I was an altar boy, and I was a good kid when I was little, and so love won't keep me sober, you know, good values, good family, blah blah blah. But I don't know how old I was. I was 5 or 6 years old, and my real dad ran restaurants, and we were at a family party somewhere, and somebody was, they were drinking. There was always an open bar there, and I remember as a little kid, I took a drink of alcohol, like give the kid a drink, and as far back as I can remember, I've always been obsessed with alcohol. Taking that one or two little drinks when I was a little kid, I loved the feeling that it gave me, and from that point forward, I was always irritable, restless, and discontent, seeking the ease and comfort of that first drink, like the big book talks about. So every chance I got, I snuck or stole a drink, and so very early, and I was just always obsessed with it. Whenever we went somewhere to any kind of party, I wasn't hanging out with the kids. I was over there hanging out with the adults, trying to sneak drinks, you know, as I could. You know, it's kind of hard when you're 7, 8, 9 years old, but I was doing my best, and I was just kind of always serious, and I was worried about things that I wasn't supposed to. I think I was 6 or 7 years old, and in California had this thing called Proposition 13 that Howard Jarvis put. And I remember being upset when that proposition was passed, and they were like, "You're too young to be worrying about that kind of stuff." And I was just worried about stuff that I wasn't supposed to be worried about. And like I said, my parents were active in the church as a little kid, and I was just kind of always torn. I mean, I knew the difference between right and wrong when I was an altar boy and I was going to the mass, and I've been trying to get drunk on the wine at church, and you know, you go through certain guilt when you're trying to get drunk on the blood of Christ, and you know, it's not what you're supposed to be doing, but that's what I was doing, and I was an evil little bastard, actually, but I loved it. I remember one Christmas I prayed to God. It's when the new Schwinn bicycles came out, the BMX bicycles. They were chrome, you know, and they had those chrome moly anodized blue rims and handlebars and things. So I prayed to God for a brand new Schwinn BMX bike and a pair of Levi's and a pair of Vans tennis shoes, you know. And what I got for Christmas was an orange Huffy, a pair of tough skins and a pair of kids, and I was pissed, you know. And God had not answered my prayer, and it was like nothing that was ever right. It was never the right size, the right color, you know, just wasn't happy. And it's hard to make me happy, but so anyways, that's the way I was. And then I don't remember when I started, how old I was. I was 6th, 7th grade. And I started drinking and using the way that I wanted to drink and use. And my life changed overnight, instantly. I know that there's people that can drink, and they cross, the book talks about crossing this invisible line that after some period of years, 5, 10, 15, 20 years, they look back and they don't realize when they cross that invisible line, it's no longer something that they have to have, and they don't know when they turn that. It's like when I took that first drink and started partying the way I wanted to party, it was overnight change. And I remember the people around me, I just absolutely shocked them because everything about me changed. And from that night forward, when I found that magic in the bottle, I found punk rock music, and I found girls all at the same night over there. And it was like, this is the life that I want. And I started running. They just didn't know what the hell had went on. And, you know, and there was like kids that I'd grown up with that after that night when I first started getting loaded, I didn't want to hang out with them because they didn't get loaded. And got that automatic kind of built-in radar. I knew all the loadies and everybody who would have stuff, and everybody was holding, and that's just what I started to do. I'm a runner. I've always been a runner. And if you piss me off or something's wrong, I'm going to run, you know. And when I was getting loaded, I would tell you that the reason I was running away constantly was because I was seeking freedom. I was living in an oppressive environment, and they were trying to control and mold me, and they were trying to make me a clone, and they were trying to kill my creative spirit and powers and everything like that, and that nothing was my fault, everything was everybody else's fault, and I just only did this because you did that kind of stuff. And the truth is, after I got sober and I listened to people in AA and I did a 4th and a 5th step, as I was running because I was just falling where the drugs and the alcohol took me. You know, the party wasn't over, and I just went where it was at. So sometimes I'd be gone for weeks, and sometimes I'd be gone for months from an early age, just constantly running and finding well-meaning people that would take me in and try to help me out, because I always had that story, you know, about the sad situation that I'd been living in, and I was free, and they'd take me. And I was talking about it this morning in the Sam house. When I get loaded, I'm no longer serious. I just become this babbling idiot, this maniac, and I'm just crazy, and I'm off the wall, and I'm running around. And I ended up in my first detox when I was 15 years old. I wasn't an emancipated minor, but I was close to it. I'd worn my parents out by the time I was 15. They tried a lot of different things to try to help me out, trying to figure out what's going to family counseling, sending me to youth groups, you know, trying to get me in the Cub Scouts. They sent me to a church youth group one time, and they were having a beach party, you know, where they burn the bonfire and all that kind of stuff. And it was at the time there was those Steak and Lowbrow commercials were on. And I didn't like drinking Lowbrow, but it was like that commercial was on, and I went and got a six-pack of Lowbrow and a bottle of vodka, and that's how I showed up at this Catholic youth group party. And I got the deacon's daughter drunk, and she stood up in the fire and renounced the church, and, you know, they disbanded the youth group after that. Everything my parents tried to do to help me out during that period of time, I just turned it back on them. you know, I just turned it back on, and I was captured one day walking down the street. I hadn't been to school for a while, and the Lakewood Sheriff came and got me with my parents, and they gave me some options. They said, this is what you can do, and this is what you can't do, and one of them was going into a psych unit, the other one was going into detox, and the other one was going to juvenile hall. And they said, this is what's going to happen if you get in trouble. And I said, I'm not in trouble. I know what I'm doing. Everything's fine. And all that kind of stuff. And a few days later, I was riding with a friend. We had borrowed his dad's car. His dad was gone for the weekend. And his dad had just got done restoring this Cougar. And it was really nice. And we were driving. We went on a beer run. And we're coming back. And he was washing his foot while he's pumping the brake. And we caused a five-car collision. We broke this little five-year-old girl's back that was in the car in front of us. And I got out and just started breaking bottles intuitively before the cops showed up. They showed up. They arrested us. There was nobody that would come pick me up that night. I wasn't living at home. And when the sheriff finally kicked me out, they were like, there's something wrong if you're 15 and nobody wants to come get you. And the heat was on. I made a decision to go into that detox. And when I went in the detox, I didn't go in there looking for an answer, looking for sobriety. I just went in there to get the heat off. Three hots and a cot, a vacation from reality. I mean, I was in there 2 days, and I realized that this is easy. At least for 30, 60, 90 days, however long I'm going to be there. Somebody's going to tell me when to wake up, when to go to bed, and I'm going to have some food. And it's just the resting time between my next run when I get out. I knew that 2 days in there, you know. And I learned all the lingo right away and how to say the right things, and at 2 days sober in that place, they said to write my plans in sobriety, and I wrote like this 32-page manifesto about all the great things that I was going to do now that I was sober, and I hadn't even been to a meeting yet. And on day three, I didn't know anything about the program. On day three in there, I got loaded on paint thinner, and on a few days later, some friends came to visit me, and they had a little bindle of those little white pills with the crosses on them. And, you know, getting loaded in detox is not a party. It's a little good indication that something might be wrong. And I'm not much of a speed freak, and I'm just bouncing off the walls, and they're loaded. And needless to say, I didn't stay sober when I got out of that place. But something happened while I was in there, as I met some people in the program that I identified with. I'd heard some truths, you know, from some people that had been in the program that just kind of stuck. And there was something that for the next year and a half, I was going to three or four meetings a week, and I was getting loaded all the time, and I could not stay sober. I could not stay sober, and I could not stay loaded, you know. And I had a belly full of booze and a head full of AA, and it absolutely was horrible. And there were just times I just wanted to leave the program and never come back, because there's these people that say they go on a five-year run, or they go away for months, and then they come back. I'd get loaded, and I'd go sit in an AA meeting, you know. I'd be coming down sitting in an NA meeting, you know. One time somebody had me, I smoked something, I don't know what it is today, and I smoked it, and I had this adverse reaction where I felt like my head was growing like a football and it was just going to explode. And I got on this bus as it came by. I just got on the bus and ended up on a detox I'd been through. And it was a closed down detox, kind of like West Care, but the nurses on staff saw that I was hurting, and they allowed me to come in there and just sit it out for the day. And they're doing an intake on the patient. And the guy was talking about how he really wasn't an alcoholic because he just didn't have all these problems, all these excuses. And I started talking about denial, you know. And I'm loaded out of my gourd, you know, and I'm freaking out. I mean, I'm just freaking out, paranoid and crazy. And that's why I'm sitting in this place, because it's kind of safe. And I'm trying to 12-step this guy. I got this stuff going in there, you know. And then I'd be getting loaded with my friends, these people that I knew. And I'd whip out the 20 questions and start reading to them. Now, when they're having a good time, they don't want to get loaded with you and start a reality check, you know. And, man, it was horrible. And I got loaded with my dad once. I said this story this morning. This is just an indication of the way that I get loaded. I got loaded with my dad once when I left that detox. I went back to live with him in Brentwood for a little while, my real dad, and I'm a junior. My dad was all proud. Here's my son, and he's bragging to all his friends about my kids here with me, and we're going to have this great relationship and create this restaurant dynasty, and he's just going on and on proud about me. And it's like 2 o'clock in the morning, and they're passing these bottles around, and I got a bottle of gin I'm drinking, and he's just glowing, you know, about pride that his son is living with him. And I start drinking, and I get mean, you know. And I said, you know, Dad, I got to tell you something. I just went through this detox, and they got these steps in the program, and there's this 8th step, and it's this immense thing. I go, I feel like I got to clear things up between me and you. And he's like, no, that's the path. We're going to leave it alone. We're moving on, you know. we're here together now. I said, no, I got to clear this so we can get better and move on. And I said, you know what? I need to make amends to you. I forgive you for all those years that you weren't there. You know, all those years that you never paid child support, all those holidays, Christmases, and you weren't there. And I'm saying this in front of his friends, you know, and that's the last time my dad got drunk with me. And in fact, like 2 months later, he pulled up one day and he had these trash bags in the back seat of his car. I go, what are those? He goes, they're your bags. And he said, you're going back home. And he dropped me off like 3 blocks away from my mom's house. And that's like one of the last times I've ever talked to him. I came home one time during that period of time, and my mom met me at the store with a squirt bottle full of holy water. She started chasing me around the house, squirting me in the back of the head, saying I was possessed, you know, and crazy stuff. And I told people, if you leave me alone, I'll be all right. I said, I was always saying that, just leave me alone, I'm going to be okay. I know what I'm doing. And hanging out with people and the meeting, fellowshipping, and all that kind of stuff. I mean, I was 90 days sober this time. I was 90 days sober before I was schooled that hanging out in the parking lot is not being at the meeting. You know, that's the kind of meetings I was going to. I was schooled that 90 days sober that hanging out in the parking lot is not being at the meeting. I just thought that's the way it was. But anyways, I ended up out in Carbon Canyon in California, and at the time it was kind of an isolated place, and I ended up out there. And I was trying to do the right thing. There was times where I really sincerely was trying to look for an answer. But, you know, I don't do dry well. I just don't do dry well. And I know there's people that are very proud. I listen to meetings a lot of time. They're really proud about being dry and that the great lengths that they're going to go to in recovery to stay dry and to fight the answer and to stay in the problem. They spend a lot of time in meetings. I listen to it all the time, just bragging about this stuff. Proud about the pain that they're going to be in because they just want to be dry and I'm not going to do the answer. I don't do dry well. Physically, mentally, spiritually, emotionally, I start dying inside. I start dying inside, and I get loaded when I don't want to get loaded. I get loaded when I don't even remember. I don't even remember making that conscious decision to start getting loaded. All of a sudden, I'm just getting loaded again. And there are times where I try to make a sincere effort as best as I could, knowing what I knew or trying to do the best. I'd got a little job out there in that canyon at a golf course, and I'd get up in the morning. I'm not a golfer. I had purple hair at the time. And I got the job, and I went and stuck my hair up in this fisherman's hat, you know, one of those Greek fisherman's hats, and I headed up there, and I got the job. And my job was to wash the golf carts down and gas them up. It wasn't anything technical. I wasn't, like, teaching people how to golf or anything. And it was just a little job. I'd get up in the morning, and I'd read my little book, the 24-hour day book that they gave me. And I'd walk, it was like a mile from the house to this golf course out there, and I'd go in there, and on the way to work, one of my jobs was to get in this golf cart with another guy and drive around and open up all these gates. And this guy was a stoner, he was like the mechanic on the golf carts. And every time we were driving around on those golf carts, he'd say, do you want to get high? He'd pull out a joint. I said, no, I told you I'm sober. I don't want to get high. And about half an hour later, I'd say, hey man, you got any weed left? He goes, no, I smoked it all, and I'd just be pissed, you know. So I'd spend the rest of the day just trying to irritate the hell out of everybody else that were, you know, that was there. I'd fill the gas golf carts up halfway so they'd run out of gas in the back nine. And I'd take the governors off of them so that these old guys, when they step on the gas, it wasn't going like 3 or 4 miles an hour. It was going like 35, 50, you know. And I was stealing golf cart parts and like I was going to start a used golf cart part business. And so it was just something to entertain myself and physically, mentally, spiritually painful, you know, trying to do the best I could, going to 2 or 3 meetings a week. And after about 90 days, I ended up getting loaded again, and I just didn't care, you know, I just didn't care. And it wasn't the worst time that I got loaded, but it was just one of those times where I just couldn't get loaded. And the magic was gone. It had been gone for a long time, you know. I mean, magic time machine, I couldn't find it. They would take me back to that fork in the road, you know, that fork in the road where all of a sudden it wasn't any more fun anymore, and all of a sudden the consequences were there, and all of a sudden, you know, everything's just crazy, and why can't I go back to the good times when there wasn't any problems? And I kept trying to recapture that, and it wasn't there. And they were getting ready to kick me out of this house that I was in again because I'd gotten loaded a couple times, and the people there were sober, and I decided to go into another detox. And I didn't go in there looking for recovery, the kind of recovery that I have today. I didn't know that I was looking for an answer. I went in there with a plan A and a plan B, because it's all I knew. You know, I was talking about this a couple weeks ago. I don't ever remember making a decision. I was listening to Hank Johnson tape, you know, where he talks about triumphant over alcohol, where you throw the martini glass down and then you say, that's it forever. I don't remember swearing off that this is the last drink I'm going to have. I just went in this place just to get well for a little while. And because I'd been around the program, I thought I knew a lot of stuff from day one in there. They hated me. My counselor hated me. And on day four, my counselor said he wasn't going to talk to me anymore. You know, and all my co-patients there hated me. And I remember I was about 12 days sober, and I'm sitting in a group in there. And when I got sober, I was 16 years old. I weighed 120 pounds. I'm 5'11", so I was pretty sucked up. And I was pale white. I'm a creature of the night. I didn't come out during the day much. And I had two nose rings. The sides of my head were shaved. My hair was dyed maroon. My nerves were shot from drinking and using. And I had this nervous twitch, you know, where my neck was constantly going like this, and my shoulders are pumping, and my knees, both my legs are pumping like a couple of pistons, and my skin's crawling, the bones in my back feel like they're hollow, brittle, like they're going to snap at any moment. I can't sleep at night, and it feels like somebody's drilling a 3-inch hole from the top of my head down to the base of my spine. And I'm sitting in this detox, and I'm crazy, but I'm fighting like hell with everybody there, fighting like hell, and I couldn't identify feelings, and, you know, they're having these rounds of feelings, and Susie says she feels happy, glad, sad, mad, less than, better than, inferior, and all this kind of stuff, and they're like, they come to me, and they're like, how do you feel? You know, I feel okay. Well, okay is not a feeling. How do you feel? I said, well, I feel well. Well, like a hamburger? And I'm like, I don't like it when you put the spotlight on me like that. And I go, you want to know how I feel? And the guy said, yeah, tell us how you feel. I said, I feel, but I can't trust you because you're not an alcoholic. You say that you love us and you trust us and you believe in us, but it's just a paycheck. Everything you know, you learned out of that book right now. You don't know how it is to be me. So therefore, I don't choose to share how I feel with you. That's how I feel. And they're like, okay, well, that's enough of you, you know. And then they went and started talking to Tom, and I said, Tom, how do you feel? He goes, I don't trust you either, you know. And so then it was attack therapy time. The whole group jumped on me, you know, and they said, you got to have a plan. You got to have a 30-day plan, a 60-day plan, a 90-day plan, 6-month plan, 1-year plan, and a 5-year plan if you're going to stay sober. I don't have a plan. I literally don't have a plan. I don't know when they're going to kick me out of this place. I don't have a plan. Looking forward, any period of time, it's like a tidal wave of crap's coming my way, and it's just getting bigger and bigger, and I can't do it. And when they're saying, you got to have a plan, you got to have a plan, so I don't have a plan. I didn't even know where I was going to live. I didn't care. It was just like one day at a time, and just staying here long enough to do whatever, you know, just beat the deal. And I'm in there, and then, so they attacked me. You got to have a plan, you know, the next half hour. Anyways, that night, it was a Monday night. I'm forever grateful my sponsor wasn't sitting home watching Monday Night Football this night, because I went to this meeting. There was like 300 people in this meeting. They all looked nice. They all smelled nice. They all smiled the same. They all looked the same. They all looked like they'd known each other forever. You know, they're all dressed up, and we came in late, and we came clanking, and their only seats that were available were in the back of the room on one of those metal carts where the chairs go. So I'm sitting in this thing, and people are walking by me, and they're looking at me, and they're laughing, and they're snickering, you know, and I'm back there doing this stuff, and I'm looking for that kind of look anyways. And at the coffee break, one person out of the 300 walked up to me in that room that night. It was a member of my home group, my first sponsor, and he said, are you new? And I said, yeah. I didn't say, no, I've been around for 18 months, you know. I was like, yeah, I'm new. And he said, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, why are you here? Now, when he asked me, why am I here, that little Rolodex started spinning in my head looking for the right answer, the one that's going to get him to shut up and walk away. You know, I don't want to give him that wrong answer where they get that look like, aha, I got you. Then they go on a tirade and start giving you all the, you know, what can I say? I'm looking for the right answer. The only thing that the answer fell on was the only the words that I could come up. I said, I just don't want to drink. I'm just trying to stay sober. And as those words are coming out of my mouth, I'm thinking, liar. Because I want to get loaded. I want to stay sober with everything inside me, but I want to get loaded with everything inside me the same way. Man, you know, when I was new, what would drive me crazy was somebody says, you have to have an honest desire to stop drinking. I was such a compulsive liar. I didn't know what honesty was. I'd spend the whole meeting trying to figure out, what is honesty? You know, do I have an honest desire? You know, I couldn't trust my feelings and emotions. Thank God for the old timers that said, doesn't matter how you feel, it's what your feet are doing. What actions are you taking? That'll speak louder than your words. That'll tell us if you're honest or not. What are the actions that you're willing to take? Anyways, when I talked to this guy and he said that thing, he's sitting there and he's looking at me and he's staring at me. and he's giving me this look, and I'm just waiting for it. And then he got a big old smile on his face, and he gave me a hug, and he said, good. Good, because that's all we can promise you, is if you do these things, you just might get to stay sober. And I was like, you know. And he said, you got a sponsor? And I said, no. And I asked him to be my sponsor, and I knew this guy for less than 2 minutes. And I asked a total stranger to be my sponsor. I didn't have a checklist. I didn't go around interviewing him, you know, what's his qualifications and his requirements, you know, and all that kind of stuff. It was just, he was the only guy there talking to me, and thank God, you know. He said, if you want to stay sober, I'll show you, because talk's cheap. Now, I like that, looking back on it, because he gave me an open invitation to judge him. You know, he said, watch me. He said, watch me, because what I do is going to speak louder than words, and I'll show you how to stay sober. And I kind of grabbed onto that. So 42 days sober, I got kicked out of that hospital because of my attitude. And they had a goodbye ceremony for me. A lot of times when they had those goodbye ceremonies, they were like cry fest, you know, everybody sits around and they, I love you, you've grown so much, you know, we'll all get a love, you know, we'll get a clean, serene pad, and we'll take our 1 year cake together and all this kind of stuff. And they're like, I hate you, I'm glad you're leaving, you're going to, you know, that kind of stuff. And my counselor gave me a relapse packet. He said, within 90 days, you're going to be loaded again, and the rest of your life, you're just going to be in and out some kind of institution. It's just the way it is. I'd been arrested twice. I'd been through 2 detoxes by the time I was 16. And he said, it's just the way your life's going to be. And you know what? That man was right that night when he said that to me. Because to my own thinking, my own devices, and my own actions, I'm supposed to be loaded right now. I'm supposed to be loaded. But see, I had a plan C that I didn't even have. That sponsor gave it to me. Because that day I got kicked out of the hospital, I called that sponsor who I didn't know, and I hadn't talked to him much. And then he said, what are you doing? I said, I got kicked out of the hospital. And he said, well, that's great news. He said, my home group's got a camp out this weekend. Do you want to go? And I said, yeah. I said, yeah, because I had nothing to lose. I had nothing to lose. Because I knew it was just a matter of time before I got loaded again. And I had nothing to lose by going with these people. So I went with them. 5 minutes into this, like, 2-3 hour drive out to the desert, I knew it was a mistake. I didn't like this guy. I didn't like the way he talked. I didn't like the way he smoked. I didn't like the music they listened to. You know, and they were taking me to the desert. You know, I was out there, and I was like, within minutes, I was cherry tomato red. I was burnt. I was miserable. I didn't know anybody in there. I wanted to leave. I wanted to run, but I was stuck. You know, and they had a big bonfire meeting that night, and I just wanted to get up out of my chair and run to the bonfire, not because I wanted to commit suicide, but I just wanted to ruin their weekend. You know. And, after the meeting, they all broke up, and they all went in little circles, you know, and there were some people were playing poker, some people were lying to each other, and other ones were just having fun, you know, and I couldn't fit in any circles. And so the only guy that I knew there kind of was my sponsor, and I went up behind him, and I'm kind of standing behind him trying to vibe out to him, because I've never had a sponsor. I didn't know what a sponsor was. Like, maybe they're mind readers that's supposed to know how you feel, what you're thinking, you know, and all that kind of stuff, or maybe they're like a therapist or a counselor to lay down the couch. Say, you know, tell me how you feel, and you run all your feelings out. And they said, you know, you're just a really a good person inside, and the world hasn't noticed it. It's just a matter of time. You just hang in there. You're a good person. And I didn't know what a sponsor was. And I'm standing there vibing to him, you know. I don't know what the words are at the time, but I'm scared. I want to run. I want to get loaded. This place sucks. You suck. I hate all of you, you know. Standing there, and he looks over his shoulder and he says, isn't this got anything better to do than stand over there lurching over my shoulder? You're really creeping me out, you know. I got pissed. I took a lawn chair, a flashlight, and a big book, and I hauled ass into the desert. I'd seen scorpions earlier that day, and I grew up in Santa Monica, and it was like, you know, I don't see a lot of scorpions there, and I got curled up like a roly-poly in that chair. I was looking back, I could see the campfire going, the glow, the people, the laughter, and all that kind of stuff. And after about an hour, it dawned on me that nobody was missing me, you know. There wasn't the cry for alarm, we lost our newcomer, where's Ruben, they didn't want ringing a bell. There was no search party, no flashlights going, and all that stuff. And I snuck into camp, and I went into my tent, and when I went to sleep to laughter. And when I woke up in the morning, I woke up to laughter. And I got out of that tent, and I was just hurting. And there was this, everybody was sitting around this old man sitting there, and he had a old pair of bib overalls. He didn't have a t-shirt on. He was smoking a cigar. He had a cane and an old fedora hat, you know, and he's talking, and they're laughing. And he's talking about things that I was still denying that I was doing at the time, that he's too old to be talking about, you know, and he should be ashamed of himself. And he's just talking. And sometimes it's laughter opens the sick mind, you know, and they were laughing and laughing. He was talking about those old Rita Hayworth posters, and he saw me sitting there, and he started talking to me, and I found out he was an old toot suitor from East L.A., back in the days when they used to go on a pike in Long Beach and fight the guys in the Navy when they strapped the wrists together, you know, and the night fights and stuff like that. And he was telling me stories about growing up and the things that he did, and I found out that he was sober 24 years at the time. And he's talking to me, and he's talking to me, he's talking to me. And somewhere in that course of that conversation, that old man said, "I know what you're going through." Yeah. And I knew when he said that, I knew that he knew, because he just described, when he was talking to me about himself, telling me his story, he had described everything that I'd been going through and all the feelings that I had. He put words to all the feelings. He'd been answering all the questions. He was just hitting all the right notes. You know, it was different than when you sit across those well-meaning people and say, "We understand what you're going through. We want to help you out. But why don't you just tell us, explain it to us, because we want to understand a little bit better." I'm like, "Wait a minute, that doesn't make sense. You just said you knew, but now you're asking me to explain it. I'm not quite sure. And if I tell you what I think's going on, you're going to tell me I shouldn't think, act, or feel that way. So screw you, I ain't saying nothing." You know? And when he said, "I know what you're going through," I knew that he knew. And, you know, and he did something for me that I think is the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just one drunken bum talking to another. The language of the heart. He made that connection that nobody else had done before. And I told him the story about what had happened the night before, you know. And he sat up in his chair and he started crying. And he said, "You know what?" He said, "That's the first miracle of your recovery." He said, "God put you in a place that you could not run away. Your whole life, every time you hit a wall of fear, you've always ran." He said, "He put you in a place where you couldn't run and you were stuck." And he said, "On the good side of that side of that wall of fear is the good, the magic." And I don't know if it was for 5 seconds or 5 minutes out there in that desert talking to that old man. 5 seconds or 5 minutes. I don't know to this day, but 5 seconds was enough. I had peace of mind. My head and my body were in the same place at the same time. I had a quiet head and a quiet heart. 5 seconds. That was magic. I hadn't had that in a bottle and a fix in a long time. I knew if it didn't get any better than that, I was overpaid. And it hooked me into Alcoholics Anonymous. It hooked me in the way of life. And that old man knew how to keep things simple with me, because I was very complicated, or so I thought. You know, I'd go to him and I'd be crazy. I'd go, "I don't know about this one day at a time crap." And he said, "Do you ever eat a Dagwood sandwich?" And I go, "Cause I knew it was forever. You know, one day at a time, it was not true. It was forever, you know." And "Did you ever eat a Dagwood sandwich?" And I go, "I don't even know what the hell Dagwood sandwich is." So he spent half an hour explaining to me how to make a Dagwood sandwich. Great detail. You know, the bread and the mustard and the mayo, and then you put another slice. I mean, he really got excited talking about making this Dagwood sandwich. And then he said, "You got to press it down, and you got to compress that thing so you can take a bite of it." He told me, "Go home tonight and make this Dagwood sandwich. Then you eat that whole sandwich. And when you're eating that whole sandwich, you convince yourself that tomorrow at noon you will not be hungry because you're eating tonight, tomorrow's lunch tonight." I thought, that doesn't sound right. You know, it sounds crazy. He said, "What's going to happen tomorrow noon?" I go, "I'm going to be hungry." And he goes, "Exactly." He said, "It's only what you eat today that's going to keep you full today. It's not going to keep you full tomorrow." He said, "Do you understand that?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "That's one day at a time. You know, you just got to stay sober till you put your head on the pillow." He goes, "Do you think you can do that? Can you stay sober till you put your head on the pillow tonight?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "That's all you got to do. Then you're a winner. You can step into the winner's circle. You can do it, you know." And I just grab on that kind of stuff. I was pissed one time, like, "How come I got to do this and they don't got to do that, and they're getting away with this and they're getting away with that?" And he says, "Did you get loaded like that?" And I say, "No." He said, "Do you ever smoke weed?" And I said, "Yeah, I smoked weed." He goes, "Do you ever put parsley in your weed?" I said, "No." "Grass clippings?" "No." He goes, "Do you ever drink beer?" I said, "Yeah, I drank beer." He goes, "Did you ever water your beer down? You know, like just put an ounce of beer in a big glass of water?" And I'm like, "No, that doesn't make sense, you know." He goes, "Do you ever snort coke or do any speed?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "Did you ever step on your own stuff?" I'm like, "No, that's insane, you know." And he said, "Why not?" I said, "Because when I got loaded, I wanted the best stuff that was going to get me loaded the best right now." He said, "Now, why would you do that with your Alcoholics Anonymous? The thing's going to save your life. Why would you water it down, step on it, or cut it?" And I could understand that. You know, he made things simple for me. And I got a couple quick stories to tell you about sponsorship and my sponsor to this day and his wife, how they know me. I was sober 18 months before I could get a driver's license, and I failed my test 3 times. And in California, you can only take it 3 times before you got to wait like another year or something. And I failed it the 3rd time, and it was a lady's last day, and she was going to retire. and she didn't want to leave like on a sour note, so she passed me because it was only by a couple of points, you know. And I went to my sponsor. I was having a hard time. I didn't have any job skills. I never graduated high school, anything. I didn't have any education, you know. And I said, man, look at the paper. There's all these jobs for drivers. He's like, you don't know how to drive. And I'm like, what do you mean I don't know how to drive? The state of California and its 18 million residents believe in me enough to give me this little piece of paper. What do you know? You know, you're just trying to hold me back, you know. And so I went down to the docks and I got this job. And I went in there and I lied. You know, the guy said, you've been driving? I said, yeah, I've been driving for years. And he said, how about these big vans with no windows? Oh, yeah, I've been driving those, no problem. And I started driving this van, and in a short period of time, on the freeway, I was trying to read a map. I bumped into this little old lady and freaked out, and nothing happened to her car. I got a little bit of pain in mine. I'm like, I'm an A, and I'm going to get drunk. And she's like, go, you know, leave me alone. And I went to go make a delivery, and I was backing up, and I backed up into this Cadillac that I hadn't seen, you know, and I freaked out, and I put in a drive, and I just took off. And I went back to this warehouse, and the owner's like, what's wrong with the car? And I go, I backed it up into a pole. And the owner and the boss are talking, and as I'm driving out of the warehouse, I scraped the whole right side of the van on the door on the way out. I'm just nuts, freaking out. And I went to go make a delivery at an oil refinery, and I saw Chevron, so there it is. So I go into this gate, and all of a sudden, these guys are running around with these big wrenches, and they're chasing me out of the plant because it was like a chemical area where there's all these explosive fumes. And like, you can't have a combustible engine in this area, you know? And they're like chasing me out of the plant. And I'm backing it out, and I backed up into a 40-foot flatbed trailer and just blew all the lights out of the back of the van. And I remember driving back to work to resign. I was pissed at my sponsor for not stopping me, you know, and that was his fault. But I learned an important lesson to this day, very important for me. Because sometimes people say some smart-ass things about, oh, you're still with them and you're still doing this and all that kind of stuff. But I learned something. Sometimes there may be 18 million people telling you, you can do that. That's what normal people can do. And you got this one person in your corner that knows you better than anybody else, and he's saying, no, it's just not right for you. And there's other times there may be 18 million people telling you, you can't do that. It is impossible. And you got that one person saying, you know what, I believe in you, you can do it. That's what sponsorship's been for me. Sometimes it's very tough love, you know, but I was listening to Gene Duffy on the way out, and he was talking about the love that Alcoholics Anonymous has, and sometimes it is tough. It's like when your mom tells you, get out of the tree, you're going to break your neck, you know, that's tough love. Sometimes you got that stuff. Don't go play out in the snow without putting your snowsuit on, you know, and you hate them at the time, but they're just doing it because they love you. And I have a son, he's 18 years old, he moved out in June, and I got to talk about him. I got to talk about him because Al-Anon's really helped me out with that kid. Another story about sponsorship. You know, boy meets girl on AA campus. We dated for a while, and we ended up having this boy. And when the boy was, when he was going to be born, I was just absolutely crazy because reality was coming crashing down on my head. I didn't know how I was going to support him. I was going to be part of the picture. It was like, I'm having a baby. I don't know what you're going to do. Blah, blah, blah. Just send the checks. And that's the way I heard it. And, no control to do this kind of stuff. And I was absolutely nuts one night in the parking lot, and my sponsor got me outside, and he put his finger in my chest, and he spoke louder into my head, and he said, it does not matter so much what you do today with that kid. What matters is that you stay here, and you stay sober, and you don't break a winning combination. Today, keep doing the actions you're taking, because he said 16 years from now, the kid wasn't even born, he goes, 16 years from now, that kid's going to come knocking at your door, and he's going to say, Daddy, I want to come home. And he said, I mean, you get crazy and you get off track, you will not be clean and sober to take care of that time. And there was a lot of times, there's a lot of things going on in that kid's life that I did not approve of, that drove me crazy, and I had to sit in step studies, and I had to talk to my sponsor and his wife and the people in the program and listen to him to stay on track and not deviate. I swear to God, almost 16 years of the date, that kid came knocking to my door.
Wow.
You know, came knocking to my door, and got to take care of him the last few years, and that was a privilege, you know, that was a privilege, and it wasn't easy, and but I had a lot of help. I had a lot of help, and he's a good kid. He's not getting loaded, and he's involved in Alateen, and thank God for Alateen, because I believe that it wasn't for Alateen And him going to those meetings, he wouldn't be where he's at today. And he's got a lot of aunts and uncles and Alcoholics Anonymous all over Southern California and around the country that love him. And he knows that, you know. And he's a good kid. You know, he's got a job, and he's trying to get going. And he, I think he's got his first steady girlfriend. I like to meet her, and he's like, doesn't want to show me, and all that kind of stuff. But he's already met her parents, so now I'm a little pissed, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I'm grateful that he still wants to go to the program, and he's going on his own, you know, and he's got a sponsor, and he's doing stuff. And I got a ton of stories. I got some AA brothers in my home group. There's seven of us that are sober over 20 years. They got sober within a year and a half of each other. And every one of us were not the most likely to succeed. We were the bent fenders. We weren't the newcomers that people were soliciting. We want you to come to our home group, you know. They weren't trying to recruit us. We were thrown away from the rest of Alcoholics Anonymous. We were the unwanted, the unneeded, and the unloved in Alcoholics Anonymous. I kid you not, you know. But our home group and the old-timers took us in, and we're not brothers in our virtues, we're brothers in our defects, and none of us liked each other, we hated each other. We ended up moving in with each other. I was living in a two-bedroom apartment, and there was five of us. We were all broke, making minimum wage, one bathroom, no refrigerator, and it was raw. You know, stealing each other's food, borrowing money, paying each other back, no privacy. I mean, you'd be shaving, you'd have to walk over the guy sitting on the toilet to get into the shower. You know, we got to learn everything each other and learn a shortcoming, see them, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I remember going to my sponsor, and I just write, you know. This guy sucks, he does this. I mean, I did real good writing, you know, taking his inventory and all that stuff. And I try to do my best on that fourth column and try to look at myself and all that kind of stuff. And he said, you know what really, really pisses you off about him? And I said, no. He goes, he's just like you. You're living in a house full of mirrors. And I was like, nah, it's not true. I couldn't see it, you know. I mean, this guy's a scumbag, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And today, some of those guys that are still around are they're my best friends, even though sometimes we just drive each other crazy and irritate the hell out of each other. But we know each other. And when the chips are down, we're in each other's corners. We don't kick each other down when we're down. We don't kick each other down because we've walked through a lot of things shoulder to shoulder. A few years ago, my buddy Dan, I was just in a bad place, and I was hurting one day. And it was just a lot of times where there's just not a lot of words to say. There's just things, you know, and actions. And sometimes the old-timers and people know that sometimes they need to sit you down and have a talk with you, and other times it's going to kick you in the ass, get you going. And it was just one of those days. And I was kind of down, and my buddy Dan walked up to me, and he looked at me, and he punched me in the shoulder, and he said, F it. And I was like, okay. Because in that one of those two little words, it just said a whole thing. He said, I know what you're going through. I know what you're feeling. I've been there myself. We'll get this thing through this thing together, and I'll stand side by side. Let's get going. And that little punch in the shoulder, that's the whole thing. That's all that said, you know. And that's what I needed that day. And I was like, okay, let's go. You know, pop your head out of your ass and keep going. I'll shut up, and I'll say this quick story here. I like it. I heard it a while back, but I was thinking of Sam House, you know, and then right down the street they got the Las Vegas Bike Weeks going on in the Cashman Center, right? So there's this newcomer, he's over there at the Sam House, and he's sharing about, you know, he's trying to get sober and he just needs help, and he's trying to find a job, and he doesn't have a car, and he doesn't have a driver's license, and doesn't have money for the bus, and there's a good, you know, mean old-timer there in the meeting. He said, I'll let you borrow my bicycle if you promise just to go look for a job. So he starts riding down the road on his little bicycle down Washington there, and he's driving by and he sees a ticket, you know, to go into the Cashman Center there to go see Bike Week, and he's walking around in there and he's looking at all the beautiful bikes and the girls and all that kind of stuff just winding around. It dawns on him after about an hour that he didn't lock that bicycle up and it's sitting outside that gate. So he's running, hauling after the gate, and he's hauling after that gate and he's praying to God, you know, those prayers that we've said. God, if you'll just let the bicycle be there, I'll go to meeting every day. You know, I'll pray and meditate. I'll talk to newcomers. I'll call my sponsor. I'm going to work the steps. Just let the bicycle be there. And when he gets there, the bicycle's there. What a miracle, right? And he gets on the little bicycle and he rides over to the club. And he runs in there and he's telling everybody, sharing. He's got to share. Raise his hand. He's got to share everybody about finding God and the miracle of finding God and what happened in his God story with the bicycle. And everybody claps and he feels good about how he shared. When he gets out of the meeting, he walks outside and the bicycle's gone. You know. And the story, the moral of that story is that prayer may get you here, but prayer ain't going to keep you here alone. God gives us the tools like the lock on the bicycle. You know, God's not going to come down and lock the bicycle for you. God's not going to work the steps. God's not going to get up and take you to the job. God's not going to allow you to go ask people for help. You know, if you're sitting around waiting for somebody to come save your ass, it's not the way it works. You got to go ask for help sometimes and say, "Help, I'm hurting. I don't know. I need guidance." You know. God bless. Thank you.
Good job.